And you did great, so thank you. There are days when it is a simple thing to find the good news in the gospel reading, and there are days when you read the text and it is so clear and so bright you couldn't miss it if you tried. These are the days that preachers long for, when the director of music says, "What hymn shall we sing?" And you think, "Gosh, I know the perfect hymn because I can see it so clearly that this is the message in the midst of the text." And then there are days like today, when the good news is so entangled up with complications and with grief and really with anger that it is almost hidden from you. Where is the good news? Since we are in the season of Lent, our focus is on a series of readings which remind us again and again that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. And it isn't simply a travel designation. It is a way of saying that Jesus is going from his ministry, the ministry of his life, and is going towards his death. Every new encounter, every new healing only brings Jesus closer to that final great week when he arrives in Jerusalem. Now, if Jesus were alive today, there would undoubtedly be all kinds of tweets and posts of the things that he said and did. It would kind of, I think, be like Beto O'Rourke's presidential campaign, you know, and he has promised to go to every county. And so Jesus, they would be reporting on him as he went from town to town to town, and there would be tweets and there would be Instagram posts. And every time there was a new thing, a healing, something happened, Peter and the boys would be taking photographs and posting them on Facebook. The pundits would be trying to guess where he would go next. And how many people do you imagine would come up to Jesus and say, "Oh, please, can we just take a selfie, just a quick one?" And yet, even without all of that media and technology, the people managed to follow Jesus from Galilee to Jerusalem and back to Galilee and through Samaria. They travel with him all over the place. There is very little evidence that they can't find him. They seem to track him without any trouble at all. There always seems to be crowds turning out to see him wherever he goes, and there doesn't seem to be any way to stop him from bringing his message. And bring it he did. From the very start, Jesus wasn't just about telling people about the goodness of God. He also did things that were signs of God's kingdom at work. And in the gospel according to Luke, the action stories usually have something to do with either healing or delivering people from the things that harmed them. And it didn't matter where he was, if he was in a synagogue, if he was walking near the tombs outside of town, or if he was surrounded by people at the seaside or on the road. Wherever he went, Jesus wanted the world to understand that God's powerful love could change lives. And he made it clear that God's grace wasn't limited to just certain people. It was for all who believed. He also spread the gospel around by giving the disciples the power to drive out demons and to heal illnesses. And he was very clear in saying that all of the things that he and his disciples were doing and saying were signs of God's kingdom coming into the world. That got him in trouble, though. Jesus didn't care about where they were or what day it was. His priority was with sharing the good news in word and in deed, and if people didn't like it, it was too bad. That was their mistake. So even when they started to talk about ending his life, Jesus kept at the work of the kingdom, mending that which was broken in the minds and the bodies and the spirits of those who came to him. So if you're still with me, I think that the scenario for today's gospel makes sense. Jesus has been doing his thing. The people are listening. Some of the folks get healed. People start to gather around. Everything is going well. It's all good. And then it starts to get strange because a group of Pharisees show up and they tell Jesus that he should get out of town while the getting is good. And that's weird. Usually the Pharisees and Jesus don't get along very well. They don't spend much time with each other, and they are certainly not on friendly terms. But they did share a common enemy in King Herod. So perhaps the motivation for the Pharisees was, we don't like King Herod, King Herod doesn't like Jesus, we're gonna help Jesus out. Maybe that's what they were up to, but we really don't know for sure. Unlike a lot of other times in the gospel, Luke doesn't tell us this was the motivation for what the Pharisees did. We just know that they show up. We also know that Jesus doesn't take their advice. Instead, he shuts them down. Most likely, he embarrasses them in front of the other people that are there, and he tells them to deliver a message to the enemy. And he calls Herod a fox, which was not a nice thing to say about another person. Think about hen house raids and chicken stealing and egg eating kinds of foxes. Think about sneaky and mean spirited. And he says all of this in front of the witnesses. Go and tell that fox Herod that I am busy. Guarantees more trouble. But Jesus is a man who isn't going to let anything get in his way or anyone. Not the king and not the religious establishment. He has things to do, and they do not include cloak and dagger conversations with the Pharisees about where he should sneak off to and what he should do. He is busy healing people's lives with the love of God. And so he wants them to just get over it. Join the party or get out of the way, because he has work to do today and tomorrow and the day after that. Herod may want to kill Jesus. After all, he had John beheaded, but Jesus is in charge of his own schedule, and he will get to Jerusalem when the right time comes. And until then, he is going to continue to share acts of love and healing. And he tells the Pharisees to move on. Now, he always has that final destination in mind. He knows, and we know, that he has been putting his life in jeopardy all along. Prophets are either in trouble with the political leaders or else with the religious establishment, and Jesus is in trouble with both sides. And he knows that when he does get to Jerusalem that final time, his life's journey will come to an end. But he's not there yet. In this story, he is far north. He is in Galilee, days away from a walk to Jerusalem. And a lot of time is going to go by before he makes his triumphant entry into the city. Luke has 6 or 7 long chapters to go before Jesus is finally going to get to the great city. And so Herod may be looking for Jesus, but at this point in time, he poses no real danger because Jesus is in Galilee and Herod is in Jerusalem. And yet, in the midst of this rant, and it really is a rant that Jesus goes off on, he stops. He's talking about how he's got work to do, and he's on the road, and he's going to do this, and buzz off Herod, and he's really, you can just sense the anger. And then he stops, awkwardly, to grieve for Jerusalem. And when you're reading it, it really feels out of place. And writers have looked at the text, and they said, you know, it feels like two weird pieces that got stuck together. And when Jesus finally gets to Jerusalem, well into chapter 19, that seems like the perfect place where he would lament over the city and cry for those people. If you go to Matthew's version of the gospel, that's exactly what happens. Jesus laments for the city of Jerusalem after he's already arrived there during Holy Week. But Luke places it here in the middle of the journey, because as much as the Pharisees might warn Jesus to run the other way, as much as his family would really like for him to just come home, as much as the apostles would like to keep him safe, Jesus' course has been set, and he knows he must go on to Jerusalem because it is only there that he will be able to complete his work. And so for a moment, he puts his anger and his frustration with the things that are happening on hold to respond to the very real hatred that he will experience, and he responds to it with the compassion of a mother. There is an ache to gather the people together, to gather them the way a mother hen gathers their chicks. There is a longing to comfort the very ones who will reject him. And he imagines them in this way as these, you know, little birds who need to be gathered together. And he laments for all that will not be. Now, I've come to believe that we don't take enough time with our laments, and there aren't enough people who truly appreciate what it is to lament. Too often it is just equated with crying or grieving, but to lament is much more, especially when we consider it from a Christian perspective. Arlind Hultgren wrote, "On the one hand, laments express sadness and describe a distressing state of affairs. But on the other hand, they presuppose that God exists, hears one's cry, and has the power to turn that which is lamentable into something that is good. And for me, that's the little shiny bit to take out of today's gospel. That's the good news for today, that Jesus lamented for God's children. He was overwhelmed with sadness and grief, but his weeping was not empty and his cries did not go unheard, because to lament is to faithfully cry out to God, believing that your sadness might be redeemed, that the circumstances can be changed. Even though lamentations are found throughout the Bible, people of faith often refuse to engage in this particular expression of faith. They question whether it's appropriate to talk to God that way. After all, laments can come enrobed in a lot of different emotions. They can come in sadness and in grief. They come in fear and in anger and in doubt. Is it okay to be angry with God? Is it okay to be absolutely furious with what's happening and to cry out to God and say, why is this happening? Why don't you do something? Why is this going on? Is it okay to throw our sadness at the feet of God, or our exhaustion or depression? Honestly, I believe that there is no emotion within us that God cannot handle, that God cannot redeem. And if Jesus can lament in anger and in sadness, then so can we. And really, we need to. We ought to. It is not good for us to hold those things in tight. We may lament for ourselves or for those we love or for the state of the world. Our lamentations may be the result of a tragic accident that shouldn't have happened, or a cancer that seems at times to be unbeatable. We should be lamenting for the people in Nebraska. It is the state with the most rivers running through it of all 50 states, and today all of them are flooding. The people in Nebraska are lamenting, and they deserve our prayers. Our hearts should pour out with lamentations for the people in New Zealand who are overwhelmed with grief this day, who are so sad because, for no reason at all, other than that they were in worship, someone came and killed and injured 50 people. We may lament at the top of our lungs or in sighs too deep for words. Our lamentations may be filled with ugly curses, the words we wouldn't say in front of our mother. God can take them. They may be framed in sweetly sung hymns. And I was looking for a different hymn. There's a program we have on our computer, and I typed in, "How long, O God?" And I came up not with the hymn I was looking for, but one I have never seen until today. It's called "How Long, O God?" And it was written by Dr. Ralph Smith, who was a professor at Wartburg Seminary in Iowa. It's our Lutheran seminary that's in the city of Iowa. It's not a very big school, but there aren't a lot of Lutheran seminaries. They're all kind of connected, and people know what's happening in place to place. Dr. Smith was the professor of preaching, and he was a hymn writer. And in 1974, when he was 44 years old, he was driving with his grandson Isaac on the day after Thanksgiving, and they were killed in a head-on collision. His wife Cindy, as well as a seminary student and a colleague from the school, survived the accident, and Ralph Smith and his grandson Isaac were buried together. There were laments heard in that seminary community and throughout the Lutheran Church for the loss of this man and for the tragedy that took him and his grandson at a time too soon for both. And the final verses to his hymn are these: "How can we hope? How can we sing? O God, set free our voice to name the sorrows, to name the pain, that we might yet rejoice. How long, O God," the psalmist cries, a cry we make our own. "Though we are lost, alone, afraid, our God will lead us home." In Paul's first letters to the Thessalonians, he says, But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so you may not grieve as others do who have no hope. We are not like those who have no hope. Our grieving and our lamenting comes in many forms, but we are not like those without hope. And I know that this is true because the response to Christ's lament, the response to Jesus' angry, grieving tears over his people comes right there in the lament. A desire of our God fulfilled as we are gathered under God's wings. We are the ones who are gathered. Jesus laments, but he says, I would gather you in and I would protect you and I will hold you safe. And so we may not find the source of our grief ended, but we will not be alone. And though we are in pain, we trust that God will come and welcome us home with open arms. We are never alone. Our relationship with God and our willingness to share all that is in our hearts and our minds strengthens us for our journey. Because we are not like those who have no hope. We have hope. Even as we lament, even as we cry out to God, we have hope because in our cries we know that God is listening and God is with us. We have hope. And even if our lamentations are not redeemed in this life, we know that they will be in the next because our God has promised. And God has never broken a promise yet.